It's a while since I've been here, and it's a lot more posh than I remember. Last time I came, I think you were still in the school, so that's how long ago it was, quite a while. And I understand that you've got quite a Polish contingent now, is that right? Are there any Polish people here? Yay! I have been to your country. It is beautiful. But if you choose to come here, you're very welcome. Listen, let's have a go at this. I might regret this, but pozdrawiam polskich przyjaciół niech Bóg was błogosławi. Oh my goodness. Oh, praise the Lord for Google Translate. Oh. Okay. Christmas is coming. We're not really allowed to talk about that yet, are we? But Christmas is coming. I'm having a little few computer problems, but we'll get there. It's not quite as planned, but that's okay. So we're going to focus this morning on just one passage from the first half of Matthew. But before we do, we're just going to remind ourselves of a few pointers that we had in that introductory video. So first of all, Matthew's writing to Jews. And one of the things that he's concerned about is showing them that Jesus is the new king in the line of David that God had promised them and that they have been waiting for. And way back in Numbers 24, after Israel had received God's law at Mount Sinai, and she was waiting to go into the promised land, the nation was waiting to go into the promised land, God had said that one day a star would rise from Judah, a king who would defeat Israel's enemies. So first of all, that was fulfilled in King David himself. And then we get a load of kings, one after another, who are pretty bad news. And in fact, if you look at Matthew's genealogy and imagine what it would have felt like to be a Jewish person listening to that list of kings read out, it wasn't very comfortable reading. And no wonder that in Micah chapter 3 in the Old Testament, God said to these kings, "Listen, you heads of Jacob, you rulers of the house of Israel, should you not know justice? You who hate the good and love the evil." And then he speaks of Israel's false prophets who lead his people astray. And so he says, you know what? Night is going to come over you, and darkness and desolation for your beloved city, Jerusalem. But the great news about God's judgment is it never lasts forever, and it's always with the hope that his people will actually return to him. And so later in Micah, he promises that he's going to raise Jerusalem up again. Nations are going to come to learn from her God, and out of Bethlehem will come a ruler who will shepherd his people. So what do we get in Matthew chapter 2? It's one of those Christmas texts. What do we get? We get a star that rises in the darkness. What's that all about? Go back and read Numbers. And we get magi from a foreign nation coming to worship Jesus. That's fulfilling what the prophets have said. And then what does Matthew do? He quotes from Micah to declare that a new ruler is born from Bethlehem who's come to shepherd Israel, okay? That's just one little glimpse at how Matthew is using one Old Testament citation. There are so many more, but that's for you to explore. But I will say this, if you are going to understand the New Testament, you have got to understand the Old Testament, okay? You have got to indwell those Old Testament scriptures and try to figure out what they're on about. So all the best with that. And Matthew's audience may wonder, well, what is this going to look like? How is this king going to compare with all the others? And what about the Roman king, Herod, that we've got right now? Violent and scheming? what's Jesus going to be like compared to him? And is Jesus going to get together an army and violently get rid of the Romans, defeat them? We're going to answer just a few of these questions this morning by looking at Jesus' encounter with one woman. Shirl, do your thing. If you want to turn to Matthew chapter 9, you can. You're free just to listen as well. Verse 18.
While he was saying these things to them, behold, a ruler came in and knelt before him, saying, my daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and she will live. Wow. And Jesus rose and followed him with his disciples. And behold, a woman who had suffered from a discharge of blood for 12 years came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment. For she said to herself, if only I touch his garment, I will be made whole. I will be made whole. Jesus turned and seeing her, he said, take heart, daughter, and your faith has made you well. And instantly the woman was made well. And when Jesus came to the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the crowd making a commotion, he said, go away, for the girl is not dead, but sleeping. And they laughed at him. But when the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took her by the hand. And the girl arose. And the report of this went through all that district.
We're going to focus particularly on the woman in the middle of that passage. The woman who's been suffering some kind of feminine bleeding for 12 years. And Mark, when he tells the story, tells us she spent all her money on doctors. So we know she's a member of the elite class because she was the one spending the money. But that also tells us, because she's spending, that she's now a widow. And as for the treatment by these doctors, well, ladies, you may like to know that there's some rabbinical writings that suggest that some of the remedies she had might have included trying to frighten her and also feeding her grain that was found in mule's dung. Nice, seriously. But despite all her money and all her efforts, she's got worse. The other thing to know about her is that in those days, women were less free to move around publicly. And for her to touch a man in public would be considered highly improper. And then there's the Jewish purity laws. So a woman bleeding was considered unclean. Anything she touched, she defiled. And basically, she was just meant to stay at home. And yet, she comes to Jesus in public and secretly touches him. And she believes that if she touches even the edge of his cloak, she will be healed. And there was a belief in those days that if you touch the fringe of the cloak of a holy man, that it had magical powers. And do you know, we don't know what this woman understands. We don't know. But she clearly believes in Jesus' power and that somehow her touching him would not defile him despite her condition. And even if she doesn't understand fully who he is. And what we do see is that God honors her faith. The imperfection of her faith or understanding doesn't matter. It's simply the fact that she reached out. And so maybe the first question for us this morning is, do I need to reach out to Jesus for anything? And will I do that? Or am I waiting till I've got more faith? Till I understand better? Till I'm pure and holy enough? I don't know if any of you have read Adrian Plass's diary, and he's thinking about that verse where it says, if you've got faith the size of a mustard seed, you can move a mountain. And so he thinks, oh, maybe I'm not quite at that level yet, but I'll practice on a paperclip. So he puts a paperclip on his desk, and he's summoning up all of the faith he can muster and authoritatively commanding this paperclip to move, which, of course, it doesn't. Faith isn't about us shouting louder, summoning up all our efforts to believe. And it's not about us being good enough either. And the thing to learn from this woman is that reaching out is all that we have to do. And she was desperate. 12 years, failed doctors, her money gone, a social outcast. But she risked all the disapproving glances from the people outside who knew her condition. She risked that to touch Jesus and reach out to him. And sometimes I think being desperate helps. It was lovely over breakfast this morning and last night just sharing with Shirley and Michael about just some of the desperate times in our lives when all we can do is reach out. You know, got nothing else to do. And so maybe if you're here and you're feeling desperate, you're in a better place than many of us. In Numbers chapter 5, the Lord said to Moses, "Command the Israelites to put out of the camp everyone who's leprous, who has a discharge, and everyone who is unclean through contact with a corpse. They must not defile their camp where I dwell among them." But what do we see in Matthew? Oh, my goodness. Well, we see Jesus freeing people from unclean spirits. We see him touching and healing lepers. And in our passage, he touches and heals a ruler's dead daughter. And then, unlike the woman's doctors, he immediately overcomes her defilement. And in Jesus, every one of those conditions, which in Numbers 5 meant you had to be put outside of the camp, Jesus overcomes them and says, "Welcome." And then, giving you a sneak preview into the second half, in Matthew 15, he redefines purity altogether. And he's been being asked questions by the scribes and Pharisees, the leaders, saying, "Hey, how come you and your disciples break the rules? How come they don't fast when they're meant to? And how come on the Sabbath you break the rules and you pick corn and you heal people when you're not meant to be doing any work?" But Jesus says, "You leaders of Israel," where have we heard that before? "Purity isn't about human traditions and rules. It's about what comes out of someone's heart." And then, even though Gentiles, non-Jewish people, were considered unclean, he heals the daughter of a Gentile woman. So in this new relationship to purity, it's people who are given preeminence, not rules, not traditions. And what's more, this includes those who society thought were the absolute least, the bottom of the pile. And so when we look at Jesus, we see children welcomed. And we see that the last, many who are last, will be put first. And then we see a ruler with public position and prestige and reputation coming to Jesus in desperate need and kneeling at his feet, which was quite a gesture for him to do. And Jesus starts to go with him to heal his daughter. But then there shows up an unclean woman, and all she has is her shame, nothing more, her shame. And Jesus turns, and he lets her interrupt him. And the ruler has to wait. That's what this king is like, okay? That's what this king is like. And I think probably each of us know what it is, for whatever reason, to feel ashamed and to feel like the least. And it could be because of our race or gender, age, health, education, financial status, or maybe the sin that we secretly struggle with and we feel ashamed. And Jesus says to each one of us this morning, if you reach out to me, however important all the people around you, I will notice you and I will stop for you and take time for you. That's what this king does. In verse 22, we're told that Jesus turned and he saw her. Now, it's really easy just to kind of slip over that and not notice, but that is so important. And there's something very powerful about knowing that you are seen. And it can be very painful to feel unseen. I remember how deeply moving it was for me on one occasion when a friend spoke to me in a particularly difficult time of my life, and she said to me, you know, she spoke about the watching world, and then she said to me, she said, Ruth, I am watching you. I see your life. And that for me was so powerful. Somebody sees. Somebody sees. And then we have Hagar in Genesis, who's out in the desert, desperate, by herself, another lone, desperate woman. And she encounters God, and she calls him the God who sees me, the God who sees me. A couple of Saturdays ago, I was sitting in the library. That's what you get to do on a Saturday afternoon if you're in Cambridge. You sat in the library, seriously. Got to get a life. And suddenly, I hear this terrible sound. And it's screeching. And I run outside and I wonder, well, are there some cats fighting? What on earth is going on? And a friend follows me, and the sound is so awful, we start to run. And we come to this lane behind the library, and in a garden gate, there's a deer, a small muntjac deer, caught in a gate as it was trying to get out. And apologies, health warning here. Behind it is a dog mauling it from behind. Blood pouring out the back of this deer. It was horrific. I'm sorry to have to give you this on a Sunday morning. Eventually, stones wouldn't work, whatever. Eventually, we threw water over the dog. We got it off. We're on the phone, you know, RSPCA. The nearest help is an hour away. We haven't got the means to kill this deer that's screaming, that's desperate. And then we put a towel over its head. And it starts to just calm down. It calms down very, very quickly. As soon as it can't see all the commotion, it calms right down. And then we just sit there and we just stroke it as it dies. And it was a horrendous experience. And yet I would not have been anywhere else, because I actually knew God was there. It was amazing. And I knew that he saw that deer. And it was a terrible but a holy moment. And I wrote this poem that I've called The Doe of the Morning, spelt Mourning. We were glad to enshroud your head, quietening your screams, calming your struggle. We were grateful for red, sprinkled hands, stroking your way to final breath rest, at least for you. Last night, I still smelled your blood and shouted silently, no, I wanted to put a stake in the ground and cry, enough. But of course, that has already been done. And even then, above the baying dogs of Bashan, your groaning was heard. Jesus tells us in Matthew chapter 10 that not one sparrow falls to the ground apart from God seeing and knowing. And then he says, you're more valuable than many sparrows. And if God sees every sparrow and he sees every deer, know that you are seen this morning. You are seen. You. And inside, whether you are singing or screaming or groaning, your voice is heard. Being cleansed from her impurity means that this woman isn't only physically healed, but she's freed too from her social suffering, and she can be restored to society. And Jesus calls her daughter, just an affectionate, respectful address. But perhaps in Matthew's gospel, where in chapter 12, Jesus redefines his family as being those who do God's will, maybe in calling her daughter, he's welcoming her into his new family, telling this social outcast that she is now a daughter of God because she's done the will of God in reaching out to Jesus. So this is what the new Davidic king looks like. It turns out he didn't come to bring a violent defeat of Rome after all. But he did come to defeat the work of Satan in people's lives. And if we've heard Jesus' first block of teaching in Matthew's gospel, we shouldn't be surprised. I want to just take you back to Exodus for a minute, where after Israel left Egypt, she came to Mount Sinai, where God's presence was manifest in a bright light. And then God gave Moses the law to teach the people before they entered the promised land. And then Israel was promised that one day she would have a new prophet like Moses who would arise for her. And here in Matthew's gospel in chapter 4, we have a quote from Isaiah saying, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. We're back to Christmas. And then Jesus, the new Moses, goes up onto a mountainside and he teaches his disciples. And what's his new law about? It doesn't say, blessed be the rich, blessed be the famous, the celebrities, the powerful. No. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek and those who hunger for righteousness. The merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, those persecuted because of righteousness. And the new promised land, it's the kingdom of heaven. And who does it belong to? It belongs to them. That's what this king is like. But do you know what? He then says, he turns after giving this law, this new teaching, and he says to his disciples listening, you are the light of the world. Let your light shine before men. And after our passage that we've read in chapter 9, where he encounters this woman, the disciples have been watching and they've seen him cast out evil spirits. They've seen him heal the sick. And what does he do in chapter 10? He turns to them and he says, right, now you go and do it. You go and do it. And so we've seen how our king treats one woman. And we ask ourselves, how do we treat people? Especially the least. I remember walking with a friend one day and saw a woman in some kind of caring role, walking with a man who had some mental disability. And great, she was taking him out for a walk. But you know what? She walked ahead and he kind of lolled along behind. And I said to my friend, I wish she'd walk beside him. I wish she'd walk beside him. I met a guy on the streets, living by the hospital so he could get there for his sick leg. And he was in such a foul mood. And even when I bought him some supper, and he still, you know, well, you could at least, you know, give me a smile. No, such a foul mood. And then I sat down at the table with him and I saw his face change. It's like, oh my goodness, she is sitting with me and talking to me while I eat. And okay, this all then went totally wrong, because you know what's meant to happen. But what actually happened was he then said, can I pray for you? So I checked he was going to pray out loud so I could hear what he was praying, because he was kind of like First Nations Indian, so I didn't quite know what was going on, but it was all fine. And then I prayed for him, and it was a laugh. God gave Israel her law, the Torah, so that people would be treated properly. And Jesus won't have anything to do with rules and traditions that devalue people, whether those are important rulers or sick women. They are all in God's image. And we maybe think of holiness as a list of rules, a list of do's and don'ts. It isn't. Holiness is about how we treat people. And we treat them with the dignity of those made in God's image. Why do we do that? Because we have a king called Jesus, the new Davidic king, and that's what he's like. That's what he does. Israel's ultimate king is God. Her human king was meant to be his representative, ruling in a way that looked like God. Now, you may remember on the video, at the beginning of Matthew, we read that one of Jesus' names is Emmanuel. Christmas, so sorry. Emmanuel, which means God is with us. Well, what does Jesus say at the end of the gospel when he sends his disciples out to do the things he's been doing? He says to them, "And surely I will be with you." He's not only the Davidic king, the new king. He's not only the new Moses, but he is God come among us. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. He is God come among us. And this is what he looks like. Oh my. And it's him that we carry when we go out onto the streets for the turning and in our day-to-day lives. And when we look at Jesus with the bleeding woman, we see God. That's what God looks like. And that's why in Matthew's genealogy, I'm trying to give you a flavor of the book here, in chapter 1, amidst the list of males in the line of David and the line of Jesus, it's male after male after male, which is how it was in those days. Matthew breaks the pattern I think it's three times to name a woman. And do you know what? Every one of those women, they're Gentiles, they're not Jewish, they shouldn't be there. One of them's even a prostitute, they shouldn't be there in the line of David and the line of Jesus. But there they are. Because that's what God does, and that's what God is like. The return of God's presence amongst his people was expected as a mark of the new age, in which it was believed that God or the Messiah would heal, raise the dead, and release captives. Three times in our passage, we're told, it depends how it's worded, it depends on the version you're using, but it basically says three times that the woman was healed from her suffering, okay? The word used there, the Greek word, is actually the word for salvation. It's actually saying she was saved from her suffering. And Matthew uses this word three times, which makes me sit up and take notice. And it's the same word that was used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament for the salvation of Israel, which would bring in that new age that Israel had been longing for. And Jesus, as God come among us, was bringing in a new age in which salvation from sickness and impurity was made possible. Okay, we're drawing to a close now, but I just want to ask, finally, what about our impurity before this God? Because if Jesus has redefined purity as being about what comes from my heart, then I fail from the start. I'm impure. I'm frequently unclean because of my sin. But there are some interesting links in Isaiah that might help us here. Because in chapter 64, Israel asks, how can she be saved? How can Israel be saved? And we learn in the same couple of verses that unclean Israel's supposed righteousness is actually like filthy rags. And you know what it's referring to there? Sorry to be a bit gross, second time. But it's actually referring to the rags that a woman would use for her bleeding. And God is saying, you know, Israel, your righteousness stinks. That's what it's like. She's impure because of her sin. And then in the next couple of verses, Israel pleads to God to look on his people, even though no one strives to lay hold of him. And then in the next chapter, God promises that when he restores Israel, weeping will stop and an infant will not die. So here in chapter 9, we see the king. And of the many people who reach out to him, we have one unclean woman singled out, seen by him and finding salvation, after which a child is raised from death. Here, Jesus is being offered as the answer to Israel's need for salvation from her sin and mine. And the woman models for us the reaching out to him, the laying hold of God, the trusting that Israel needed to do to be made clean, and that I need to do too. And so you and I can reach out and touch Jesus boldly, boldly, with whatever little faith we have. And we too find ourselves saved from our impurity, cleansed from our sin, seen by God, included in his family, and knowing life restored. That's what this king looks like. That's what he is like. And then in turn, we go and we spread the kingdom of heaven to everyone we meet. Amen.